Penguin Random House Audio presents The Magic Kingdom, a novel by Russell Banks, read for you by Danny Campbell, with a foreword and afterword read by MacLeod Andrews. To Chase, the Beloved, and for my brother, Stephen Banks. Foreword. The late Harley Mann, a semi-retired speculator in Florida real estate, told this story to a tape recorder over several months in 1971. As the reader may wonder from time to time who edited and shaped the content of Mann's now 50-year-old tapes into a more or less coherent narrative, it may be stated that it is I, Russell Banks, the named author of this book, who have taken on that task. The reader may also wonder why the publisher of the book chose not to bypass said author and simply transcribe Harley Mann's narrative straight from the tapes, word by word, just as Mann himself spoke them in 1971. Anyone who has read verbatim transcriptions of recorded memos, conversations, meetings, and phone calls, or transcripts of wiretaps by the FBI and other intelligence agencies, of conversations between suspected criminals and terrorists, we'll understand the need for a figure like the author to stand between whoever has been taped or wiretapped and the reader. Unedited transcriptions convey neither the voice nor, in many cases, the meaning of what was said or the intent of the speaker. Also, the reader should keep in mind that when the late Harley Mann recorded his story, he was in his early 80s, a somewhat eccentric, crotchety, impulsive, and garrulous old man, fond of digressions and personal asides, who, like all of us when speaking at length without a written text, could be repetitive, self-correcting, inexact, profane, irrelevant, and sometimes inaudible. For those reasons, and since I am the person who discovered the tapes 22 years ago in a storm-soaked cardboard box in the basement of the St. Cloud, Florida Public Library, the publisher thought it useful to have me edit, cut, and when necessary, overwrite, annotate, and summarize the content. There may have been a bit of legal anxiety as well, which is why I was advised by counsel to change the names of certain still-living individuals. Harley Mann's story came to my attention in the following way. Back in October 1999, when Hurricane Irene passed over the Florida Peninsula on its way to wreak havoc on upstate New York and New England, the lakes of South and Central Florida overflowed, and much of the city of St. Cloud was flooded. A month after this storm, at the end of a solitary weekend fishing trip at East Lake Tehopacalaga, before returning to my home in Miami, I stopped in St. Cloud for a lunch at Krabby Bill's, a local lakeside restaurant I favor. An hour later, emerging from the cool air-conditioned gloom of the restaurant into the sweltering glare of the midday sun, I was unexpectedly struck by the look of a building at 10th Street and New York Avenue, surrounded by a clustered mix of live oak trees and cabbage palms on the far side of the parking lot. There was nothing especially attractive or architecturally interesting about the building, but I was somehow drawn to it and wondered why I had not noticed it before. It was the Veterans Memorial Library, a four-square, tan-brick building that looked like a 1950s bank from my Massachusetts hometown. In South Florida, in the final decade of the 20th century, it seemed an architectural outlier, oddly out of place and almost antique. It would have seemed more natural, more authentic, I thought, in a Disney World Potemkin village, embellished by transplanted elm or maple trees in a mythic New England suburban diorama, than here at the heart of the postmodern semi-tropical city of St. Cloud, Florida. Curious and mildly intrigued and inexplicably agitated, and for vague and unnamed reasons wishing to examine the building more closely, I walked across the parking lot and entered the library. The dimly lit lobby and main reading room were cooled by air conditioning and appeared to be deserted, except for a slim, young, ponytailed female librarian wearing a flowered skirt and pink blouse and luminous bright blue running shoes. A hand-lettered cardboard sign taped to the wall at the east end of the lobby said, "Free Books." A drawn arrow pointed down the wide stairway to the basement. The basement was dark and damp, 20 degrees warmer than the lobby above, due to a bulkhead door open to the backyard. Mildew and black mold crawled up the poured concrete walls. A dozen or so sodden cardboard cartons and banker's boxes filled with old books and magazines and quarterly periodicals were stacked nearby. Beyond the bulkhead door was a dumpster on the gleaming green lawn. The rotting books and magazines and periodicals were evidently set to be tossed into the dumpster and trucked to a landfill. Casting a glance over the contents of the boxes, I saw nothing of interest, until I noticed at the top of one pile a packet of what looked like old-fashioned quarter-inch reel-to-reel tapes. The box was soaked through, but the tapes themselves appeared to have been protectively wrapped in clear plastic and undamaged by water. Someone with a wide-tip marker had written, "The Magic Kingdom," on the packaging. Whoever had been lugging the boxes of books and magazines from the cellar to the dumpster seemed to have gone on a lunch break. In any case, no one was present in the basement to see me slip the package of tapes into the wide side pocket of my fishing vest and walk up the stairs to the main reading room. The librarian asked if I had found anything of interest down there among the rubble. Bringing her attention to the packet of tapes might make her want them back, I thought, so I said, "No, everything's waterlogged." I then departed the library and returned to my parked car and boat trailer and drove back to my home in Miami. In a limited sense, then, the tapes were stolen from the St. Cloud Public Library. I had no way to listen to the old-fashioned reel-to-reel tapes, however, and for several years they sat stacked, forgotten among unread books on a shelf in my office. I did nothing with them. I did not even unwrap them. Finally, while reorganizing my personal library, I decided to put the tapes in the trash. But something like an invisible hand on my sleeve kept me from throwing them out. Reluctantly, since I would likely never use it for any other purpose, I went ahead and purchased, via eBay, a working vintage reel-to-reel tape recorder. When the machine was delivered to my condominium and I was able to listen for the first time to the recorded voice of Harley Mann, I learned that my machine was uncannily like the Grundig TK-46 recorder described in Harley Mann's Reel 1. It was in fact the same make and model. Purely coincidental, of course, but only the first of many unsettling parallels and resemblances between my own story and Harley Mann's, and no doubt one of the reasons why I have gone to the trouble of transcribing the tapes and bringing that transcription to the public. Harley Mann himself is presumed to have died shortly after completing his account. A few months after I first listened to the tapes, on the last of my several return trips to St. Cloud, seeking biographical details from the life of Harley Mann that, for reasons of modesty, discretion, or guilt, he may have omitted from his account, I made the surprising discovery of what appeared to be his gravesite. By then, the young librarian in the blue running shoes had become my part-time unpaid research assistant. She was especially helpful in locating the records behind the purchase of 7,000 acres of land in nearby Narcoosie in the 1890s by the Shakers of Mount Lebanon, New York, and the eventual mid-20th century purchase of that same land by representatives of the Walt Disney Company. She prefers not to be named in this account, however. From her, I learned of the existence of what we initially thought was the Shaker burial ground. The true location of Harley Mann's body is unknown, but his death has been memorialized by someone who must have loved and admired him and somehow knew his story. In a northerly corner of the land, where the Shaker colony called New Bethany once stood, there are three small, barely visible bronze plaques, one of which bears his name and dates, Harley Mann, 1890 to 1972, and the word Shaker. The second is inscribed with the name Sadie Pratt and the dates 1883 to 1910, and below the dates, Shaker. The third marks the grave of Eldris Mary Glynn, 1838 to 1911. One must assume that Harley Mann's grave is empty. Possibly all three are empty. Nobody has been buried in that cemetery, if it is indeed a cemetery, since the last of the Florida Shakers returned to upstate New York over a century ago. They are the opposite of unmarked graves. The land is now owned by the Walt Disney Company, and the burial ground itself is protected by Florida state law from disruption or appropriation or resale. It is overgrown and difficult to access. Located.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?